Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Katie Weaver and Jill Robbins. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, South Korea said on Thursday it plans to ban trading of cryptocurrency, including the popular Bitcoin. The announcement sent Bitcoin prices much lower and created unrest in the cryptocurrency market. Justice Minister Park Sang-gi said the government was preparing a bill to ban trading of the virtual money on South Korean currency exchanges. He said, "There are great concerns regarding virtual currencies, and the Justice Ministry is basically preparing a bill to ban cryptocurrency trading through exchanges." The price of Bitcoin in South Korea dropped as much as 21% immediately after the minister's comments. Around the world, one Bitcoin was valued at about $14,000 on Thursday, January 11th. Over the past year, the price moved from less than $1,000 in January 2017 to a high of $19,000 last month. Bitcoin is different from national currencies, which are supported by governments and national banks. It is stored as a line of computer code. It is not printed on paper or something you can hold. Bitcoin is similar to real money because you can spend it without using your real identity, as you do with a credit card. People who want to buy and sell things anonymously like Bitcoin. By Thursday afternoon, more than 55,000 South Koreans called on the government to stop the proposed ban. After the price drop, the South Korean president's office said a ban on cryptocurrency exchanges had yet to be finalized. It said the ban was one of the measures being considered. A press official at the Justice Ministry said the proposed ban on cryptocurrency trading came after enough discussion with finance ministry and financial officials. Once a bill is written, legislation for a ban of virtual coin trading still requires a majority of the vote in the National Assembly. It is a process that could take months or even years. Mun Chung-young, chief analyst at EST Security, told Reuters the ban will make trading difficult here, but not impossible. Mun added, "Keen traders, especially hackers, will find it tough to cash out their gains from virtual coin investments in Korea, but they can go overseas, for example, Japan." Park Nuk-sun is a cryptocurrency expert at NH Investment and Securities. Park said, "Some officials are pushing for stronger and stronger regulations because they only see more jumping in, not out." South Korean officials are worried that the rising value has fueled huge demand for cryptocurrency in the country. They fear college students and housewives are hoping to get rich quick by investing. They likened it to a game of chance. The news of South Korea's proposed ban came as governments around the world are looking to control the trading of cryptocurrencies.
Observers say French President Emmanuel Macron communicated two important messages during his recent visit to China. One was about the huge possibilities cooperation between China and Europe could bring, and Macron's support of that effort. The other was a warning not to underestimate European concern about China's possibly unfair trade practices. These include Chinese restrictions on investment in many businesses and industries. Mathieu Duchatel is Deputy Director of the Asia and China Program at the European Council of Foreign Relations. He said that Macron's visit will influence actions not only in France, but in other countries also. He wants to present himself as a leader of the European Union, Duchatel said. But at the same time, I think he wants to send a signal that Europe and the EU are in better shape than many think in China, he noted. Duchatel said that Europe, the United States, and Australia are all expressing concern about China's trade practices. Many are coming to terms with the reality that China is no longer the factory of the world, he added. But it is clearly a country that has very strong ambitions in terms of economic leadership for the world, and it is not a market economy. Macron presented Chinese President Xi Jinping with a gift of an 8-year-old horse named Vesuvius. He promised to visit China at least once every year while he serves as France's president. He also said that he is ready to work to get the Europe-China relationship into the 21st century. The two sides signed major trade deals during the visit. China's president said the two countries will deepen their strategic cooperation. During his first stop in Xi'an, Macron expressed French support for China's huge trade and commerce project, the Belt and Road Initiative. Xi'an was once the starting point of the Silk Road, the name for roads and transportation links used by traders many centuries ago. In a speech, Macron noted that the ancient Silk Roads were never only Chinese. If they are roads, they cannot be one way. I'm Katie Weaver.
On March 5th, Jasmine Hughes wrote in a New York Times blog, "Recently, at an IRL party, that is, a party that takes place in real life, as opposed to where I generally live, which is on the internet, a guest asked a friend and I how we met." The sentence includes a common error I have been seeing and hearing more and more often lately. The error is using the subject pronoun I when the object pronoun me should be used. Even President Obama can be heard using I for the object of a sentence. At his first press conference on November 7, 2008, he spoke about being invited to tour the White House. Well, President Bush graciously invited Michelle and I to meet with him and First Lady Laura Bush. English has 8 subject pronouns. I, you, he, she, it, we, you, and they. Subject pronouns show the actor in a sentence. For example, in the sentence, I speak English, I is the actor. English also has 8 object pronouns. Me, you, him, her, it, us, you, and them. We use an object pronoun to show the receiver of the action in a sentence, as in, she gave the book to me. In that sentence, me is the receiver. People often confuse subject pronouns and object pronouns in sentences with 2 receivers. Take the sentence, President Obama gave an award to my brother and me. We can easily see the need for an object pronoun because of the preposition to. But some sentences do not have prepositions, as in, Obama asked my brother and me some questions. The sentence still needs the object pronoun, me. However, some people might want to say, Obama asked my brother and I some questions. You know that sentence has a grammar error because I is not an object pronoun. I think the confusion about I and me comes from instruction we get as children to be polite. When we mention ourselves and another person in a sentence, we are told to put the other person first. For example, we might be reminded to say, my brother and I went to the White House. Saying, I and my brother went to the White House is grammatically correct, but would sound impolite or rude. So, English speakers who are faced with 2 people in the object position in a sentence often grab for the phrase, somebody and I. They do not notice the phrase is grammatically incorrect. It just sounds more polite. Another theory about the I or me error comes from a 2009 New York Times article, The Eyes Have It. Writers Patricia T. O'Connor and Stuart Kellerman guess that people correct children who use me instead of I so much. The children grow up to use I even when it is wrong. They explain the term for this linguistic phenomenon is hypercorrection. Back to Miss Hughes, her party, and the New York Times blog. Her sentence should be rewritten as, a guest asked a friend and me how we met. Shortly after I called the error to the newspaper's attention, it was corrected. A simple way to check for the correct pronoun in a case like this is mentally to eliminate the second person. Try saying in your head, a guest asked me how we met, or a guest asked a friend how we met. That simple check makes choosing the correct pronoun easier. Now, you will always know the right pronoun to use. Take it from me. I'm Jill Robbins.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning English. I'm Steve Ember. Last week, we talked about slavery in new American states and whether Congress could set the conditions for statehood. The Missouri Compromise in 1820 settled the issue for a short time. The compromise said that Missouri could enter the Union as a slave state, and Maine could enter as a free state. By approving these two states at the same time, Congress kept a balance of power in the Senate between slave and free states. But the compromise also said no more states in the Northern Louisiana Territory could be admitted as slave states. As a result, slavery could not enter the new areas of the United States. Some people did not like the compromise. They said it limited the ability of slave owners to settle in the country's western territory. Others said the Constitution did not permit Congress to say that new states had to be slave or free. Even President Monroe did not believe the government had the power to make such decisions. Yet he approved the compromise. He was trying, he said, to avoid a civil war. Monroe's decision to approve the compromise did not hurt his election chances in 1820. There was, at this time, really only one party, the Republican Party, and he was its leader. The opposition Federalist Party was dead. It was no longer an election threat. So Monroe was the only presidential candidate in the election of 1820. He received the vote of every elector except for one. William Plummer of New Hampshire voted for John Quincy Adams. He explained later that George Washington had been the only president to get all the electoral votes. Plummer said he did not want anyone to share this honor given to Washington. Monroe's first 4 years as president had been successful. He had increased the size of the United States. Florida was now part of the country, and the problem of slavery had been temporarily settled. There had been economic problems, some of the worst in the nation's history, but the situation was getting better. And the nation was growing. As it grew, new problems developed between its different sections. There were really three separate areas with very different interests. The northeastern states had become the industrial center of the nation. The southern states were agricultural, with large farms that produced cotton, rice, and tobacco. Much of the work on these farms was done by slave labor. The western states were areas of small farms where grain was produced with free labor. It was a place where the land did not cost much and where people could make a new start and build a new life. This division of the nation into different sections with opposing interests ended the one-party system of Monroe's administration. The industrial Northeast wanted high taxes on imported products to protect its industry from foreign competition. This part of the country also believed the national government should pay for roads and waterways to get their products to markets. The South did not agree to high import taxes. These taxes raise the prices on all goods, and import taxes on foreign goods might cause foreign nations to raise import taxes on Southern cotton and tobacco. The South also opposed spending federal money for roads and canals. The mountains through parts of the Southern Atlantic states would make road building difficult and canals impossible. The Western states supported government aid in building roads and canals. The Ohio and Mississippi rivers were the only inexpensive transportation systems for moving their products to markets. The Westerners also supported high taxes on imports because they believed such taxes would raise the prices of their agricultural products. The separate interests of these different sections produced an exciting campaign in the next presidential election. Each section had at least one candidate. Several had more than one. The campaign began almost as soon as Monroe was elected for the second time. At one time, as many as 16 men thought of themselves as presidential possibilities. By 1822, the number had been reduced to 6 men. John Quincy Adams was the only Northern candidate. He was an extremely able man. He was at the time Secretary of State, and there were few jobs in government he could not do and do well. But many people found him cold and questioning. His father was John Adams, the second president of the United States. The West had two candidates. One was Henry Clay of Kentucky, popularly known as Harry of the West. He was a great lawyer, congressman, Speaker of the House, and senator. The other was Andrew Jackson, known as Old Hickory, the hero of the Battle of New Orleans during the War of 1812. Jackson knew little about government. He was a fighter, a man of the people. In the election of 1824, Jackson got the most electoral votes, 99, but he needed 130 to win a majority. The Secretary of State, John Quincy Adams, was second. Treasury Secretary William Crawford was third, and Henry Clay of Kentucky was fourth. Because none of the candidates got a majority of the votes, the decision went to the House of Representatives. The House voted on only the three top candidates for president. The most powerful man in Congress, Henry Clay, was not therefore a candidate. But Clay's support would be the greatest help any of the candidates could receive. All three wanted his support. Treasury Secretary Crawford had suffered a serious illness before the election, and his health was bad. Clay felt he could not support him for that reason. This left Adams and Jackson. Clay did not agree with all of Adams' policies, but he did believe Adams had the education and ability to be president. Clay did not like Jackson, the hero of New Orleans. He knew Jackson was poorly educated and easy to anger. Clay did not think Jackson would be a good president. So Clay decided to support Adams for president. He said nothing about this for a time. Several of Clay's friends visited Adams. They told him that Clay's supporters in the West would be pleased if Adams, as president, named Clay as Secretary of State. Adams told them that if the votes of the West elected him president, he would put a Westerner in his cabinet. But he would not promise that the Westerner would be Clay or that the cabinet job would be Secretary of State. Clay had still not said publicly which candidate he supported. But late in January, a Philadelphia newspaper published an unsigned letter. The letter charged that Clay and Adams had made a secret agreement. Clay, the letter said, would give his support to Adams. In exchange, Adams would name Clay as his Secretary of State. Clay was furious. He not only denied the charge, but offered to fight a duel with the letter writer. But whoever wrote the letter to the newspaper refused to say anything. Clay was sure Jackson's supporters were responsible. Snow was falling in Washington on the morning of February 9th, the day that Congress would elect the president. At noon, members of Congress walked into the House of Representatives. Each state had one vote for president. Adams was sure he would get the votes of 12 states. Crawford had the votes of 4, and Jackson, 7. New York was the question. 17 of the New York congressmen were for Adams, and 17 were against him. Adams needed just one of these votes to get the vote of New York and become president. One of those New Yorkers opposed to Adams was a rich old man who represented the Albany area, Stephen Van Rensselaer. Although Van Rensselaer had supported Crawford or Jackson, he really was not sure now whom to support. When the New York congressman voted, Van Rensselaer was still not certain. He put his head down on his desk and asked God to help him make the right choice. After this short prayer, he opened his eyes and saw on the floor at his feet a piece of paper with Adams' name on it. Van Rensselaer picked it up and put it in the ballot box as his vote. This gave Adams the vote of the state of New York and made him the next president of the United States. 2 days later, Adams told President Monroe that he had decided to offer the job of Secretary of State to Clay. He said he was doing so because of the Western support he had received. Clay accepted the offer. Now Jackson was sure that Clay had sold his vote to Adams for the top cabinet job. He wrote to a friend, "Was there ever before such barefaced corruption? What is this trade of vote for office, if not bribery?" Jackson, himself a senator, showed his feelings when the Senate was asked to approve Clay as Secretary of State. He voted no, and 13 other senators joined him against the nomination. But they were too few to prevent Clay from getting the job. With Clay as his Secretary of State, John Quincy Adams began his first term as president.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.